All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from the Borough of Queens in New York City. It is the 5th day of April, 2023. I would like to mention my own newsletter, Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. It is, I think, a very exciting time to own junior gold exploration companies, the companies that are really finding massive amounts of gold and silver and other minerals in the ground. I think we're in a commodity bull market. We'll get the opinion of some of my guests this week on that. But if you'd like to subscribe to my letter, go to miningstocks.com, miningstocks.com. And if you'd like to let us know what you think of this show, you can send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questions4taylor@gmail.com. I've titled today's show, The Petrodollar's Demise and You. As the economic power of China is on the rise and the economy of the US in decline, major changes are taking place geopolitically. As the petrodollar morphs into the petro yuan, it will have a major impact on the economic well-being of Americans. And how should we prepare for the changes that are to come about? Well, that's what I want to ask our guests today. Chen Lin, John Rubino, and Frank Holmes are my guests for this week's show. And I'm happy to tell you that Chen Lin is with me right now. Thanks for joining me, Chen.
Thank you, Jay. Glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you here again for the first time on our video platform. So it's really good to have you. I guess I should tell people that your newsletter, you're still writing a newsletter, Chen. I believe it's called What is Chen Buying? What is Chen Selling? And folks can go subscribe to that by going to chenpicks.com. I've got that right. Right, Chen?
Yes. Thank you, Jay.
All right. You bet. All right. So here we have an increasing number of countries that are deciding that they don't necessarily have to have dollars when they export their products. Most notably, perhaps, is Saudi Arabia that is selling oil to China and India and other countries now. And they're saying, well, we don't have to have dollars. We'll take yuan or we'll take rupees or we'll take other currencies. What do you make of this, Chen? Is this a really big deal that's taking place? Is it something that's going to unwind over a long period of time? Or what are your thoughts about it?
Sorry, I just missed one of them, there's a trend we are heading towards that is use different other currency other than US dollar. That's definitely, I see gold also another possibility, okay, using gold as trade, because people increasingly think gold is a hard asset.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there are also Chinese yuan, you said one possibility. China is trying to fight back because the trade war, you know, United States hit China with this jackhammer, China fight back with the jackhammer. One of those was China brokered Iran and Saudi Arabia deal, right? Mm-hmm. And then Saudi Arabia just cut their oil output along with Russia and with all the other oil producing nations. That's a big swipe of the face of the administration, United States. And there are also talks that there's a massive weapon sales from China to Saudi Arabia. It's mm-hmm. in talk right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think all these are related to this trade war, right? So United States are hitting China hard on all this tariff and the other. Yeah. China also fight back on different areas. They don't fight directly because China has a huge surplus with the United States. So they can't fight this way, but they have to find another way. One of the areas is de-dollarization. They're trying to use Chinese yuan as substitute in many other trade. They also try to have a parallel SWIFT system that the United States cannot kick someone out of the global trading system. They can use the yuan trading system. So that's another area they're working on. Mm-hmm. And right now, Middle East is increasingly want to become independent from United States. And as well as Russia and China, they want to be on their own. They want to be their financial hub. They saw a golden opportunity because SWIFT abandoned their neutrality. Mm-hmm. Okay. So a lot of money are moving out of Swiss. Actually, that led to part of it led to the Credit Suisse demise. Mm-hmm. So I heard Middle East is going to be the hub Dubai or some other places. They want to be the future financial hub. They may not like New York, do not like London, do not like Switzerland, may not like Hong Kong because too close to China. They want to be Middle East. So they want to be their own independent. They want to buy their own weapon. One day they may want to kick United States Army out.
Yeah.
So that's the trend we're going. And the dollar in the global trade is going down as we see it.
Right, Chen. And of course, for the longest time, China, the net export countries would take the dollars they earn from their exports and recycle them into treasuries. That's not happening as I understand it. We're seeing a decline in China's holdings of treasuries. They're not selling them all at once, but gradually unwinding them, and that's happening from Japan and other countries as well. But if the dollar is in decline and it's not used in international trades as much as it was, then I would think that might have some impact on interest rates as well. If those countries aren't willing and able to buy treasuries, either the United States has to save more money and buy treasuries, people in the U.S., or they're going to print money. What do you think the impact might be on interest rates longer term then?
That's an excellent question. That's what I see is the old 0% interest rate decade of the 0% interest is gone. It's gone forever. Uh-huh. We will be facing higher inflation and a higher interest rate for the coming decade. Mm-hmm. The issue right now is a lot of people are not adjusted to it. I just talked to a real estate guy. They're still thinking the mortgage will come down to 3% to 4%. Yeah. They're still hoping. But what if it doesn't happen? Right? Yeah. There's the biggest problem right now for United States is the commercial real estate. Commercial real estate, there's so many empty office buildings. You know that in Manhattan.
Right, for sure. Right?
So but they signed long-term lease, 5-year, 10-year lease, but that was signed many years ago. So those will gradually come in to the end, right? I mean, in the next few years.
Right.
And then the company will just walk away. We can work from home. We don't need so many. There will be more. And then when they roll over, they're borrowing money. Remember, there was so much leverage in the system.
Right.
So how can they roll over to the new loan? I mean, they did not even, you know, they're underwater already. So that could be an issue in the coming years to unwind. So people are so used to the low interest, zero interest, they just think it will go back. Inflation is coming down, not so fast.
No, I think you're right, Chen. I would agree with that. But if we're in an inflationary environment now, we've had, and some people argue, as do I, that we were in an inflationary environment in the financial markets for decades. And now that we are heading into maybe a disinflationary environment in the financial markets, but a bull market, inflation in the commodities. You are super bullish on silver as much as anybody I know. Talk to us about silver. Why do you like it so much?
Oh yeah, I see the incredible demand of silver, mostly I see the growth from the solar panel industry, but there are also other areas. So silver also have other industrial usage. Right? So, so a lot of people question, are you sure? I have the data. The data doesn't lie. The data shows even the country like Brazil, before the current Lefty administration last year, they were growing at 70%, right? So in the United States, it probably may not be, worthwhile to install solar panel because it's expensive, labor is expensive, and these land acquisition is expensive, but for anywhere outside United States, it's the cheapest energy available. So technology, when they hit the threshold, it just go like this. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to the early days of electrical car. So it's the cheapest way to get energy. And then people, especially outside United States, land is cheap, labor is cheap. They don't have too much regulations. They can just get a land and then put solar panel on that. And it's my land. I don't need a permit or anything. So that's actually just start to hit. So I see the number just came out, for example, for the first 2 months, right? We just, this year coming, the 3 months come, I only have 2 months, for 2 months from China, which is the largest solar panel producer. They're growing about 70-80% versus last year, same time. That's kind of similar to what we saw last year, Brazil going to 70%. So if you believe, agree with me, solar panel is growing at just conservatively 50 to 70%, 50 maybe to 80, 75, 80% range each year, then all the forecasts of Silver Institute, Metal Focus Group, even our friend Jeff Christian, CPM Group, all these are off. So we'll see dramatic increase of demand. I have some very conservative estimate that silver demand will triple every 5 years. That's quite conservative, okay? So you think about silver already take about 12-13% in 2021. That's a Silver Institute report. They still revised 2022. They're gonna have another revision. Because they're so far behind, they have another revision this month in April. Actually, they will come to New York. I don't know if you're going to go to the event, but I cannot. I'm going to visit a very exciting silver company in Japan. And you and me are probably of interest. We can talk about that later.
Oh, yeah.
So, there will be jump of last year's demand again. So they were just so far behind. Every analyst is so far behind. And I see more forward looking. I'm an investor. I see the strong demand of silver, and silver will take last year already a huge deficit. It will be more and more deficit in the coming years until silver really take off. And a high silver price will be, will dampen the demand. So we will reach some equilibrium, maybe much, much higher price.
Well, I think around $24 now in silver, and technically, I think close to a breakout. Maybe people should pay a lot of attention to silver right now. The name, you're going to visit a company in Japan, Chen, just quickly.
Yeah. I'm going to visit with Dr. Quentin Hanning. And I just learned another big commodity fund are going to join me.
I
do not want to name who, but you know them.
Yeah. All right. Can you name the company? It might be one you and I both know. In Japan.
Yeah, it's called Irving Resource. If you know Japan, they stopped exploring after Second World War, their defeat of Second World War. So almost 100 years, 90 years, okay? So through this, they even don't have a rig. So now they just opened up for exploration. There are two companies. One is called Japan Gold. That's a alliance with Barrick, fully valued. I think the valuation already very high. There's another little company called Irving. They are aligned with Newmont, right? Yes. Newmont just gave them a lot of money at the end of last year, and they just got their own rig. It's so hard to find a rig in Japan. They got their crews from Peru, from Mexico, and then they're drilling right now. They just drilled through. We were in their presentation, right? They just drilled through the area, the top layer. They hit area they never drilled. Japanese never drilled before, and they seem to have a very exciting area. At least from picture, looks very exciting.
Yeah.
So I'm going to witness my own eyes how exciting it is Dr. Quentin Hanning and some very big fund managers.
Yeah. Well, Quentin has talked about Irving on this show just recently, Chen, and I look forward to hearing what you have to say when you go visit them. Well, just real quickly here, because we've got a little short on time here. Energy, you've become much more bullish on energy now, I think, right?
Yeah, because I see the Ukraine war going to last for a while. As long as the war is lasting, there's a lot of opportunities in energy. We don't have too much time. I just mentioned a little bit what I really like. Mm-hmm. There's one company, they're fracking in Egypt. It's first time ever in Egypt that's going to be fracked. Uh-huh. Okay, you see the Egypt from the right is Saudi Arabia. On the left is Libya, on the south is Sudan. All these are oil-producing countries.
Yeah, right.
Egypt is not, because oil is tight. Mm-hmm. So they're going to deploy the Eagle Ford to frack in Egypt. The first time in history, they're going to frack that, and they're going to drill a horizontal well. So this is going to be, I think, the God creating all these oil, they can't just around Egypt, right? So they probably a lot of Egypt, oil in Egypt that was never able to discover, to commercially produce.
Yes.
So that's why they're fracking. Last week they have press release, they're fracking right now. Tag oil. Okay, so that's something I'm very excited. And the result come out, and they're going to drill horizontal well starting next month. So first ever.
What is the name
about that Eagle Ford?
Chen, what is the name of it and the symbol?
Tag oil, TAO is a Canadian symbol. Yeah, it's a very exciting part. Another Tenaz, I think we mentioned that. I mean, energy company sometimes is so cheap, and this company, you can count the dollar. If oil stay around this price, you know, and right now actually very high, $80, we're talking about $60, they will be trading at cash at the end of the year. The company is buying back shares. And then they will be trading, and how cheap can they get to, right? So, and then they're looking to do some very accretive deals. They're looking to you know, to get more blocks, and they have some is in Europe, some is in Canada. So they have both. So it's a very cheap energy stock. And so I just bring two of those. TNZ is a symbol in Canada.
And it's, and the name of the company again is?
Tenaz, TNZ,
right.
We talked about that before,
Yes, I we have, All right, well, real quickly then, because you are the king of biotechs, that's the way I look at it, Chen. You've done extremely well with biotechs. What are a couple of your favorites?
Well, I have to say, last year was one of the toughest years in biotech in history, and I usually, every year, have a 10-bagger. Last year was first time in all my history, in my I have no 10-bagger in either biotech or energy or mining. But I'm pretty confident, you know, that things have changed. Probably will have a couple of 10-baggers. One of these is last year's my top holding right now is Magical, MDGL, right? So that was my last year's 5-tiger number 3. The stock already 5-fold, so I'm not sure you want to chase here, but if you own that, you follow on your radio show, I got a 50, now 250. We sold at 300, so I'm trying to buy back at 250. I think this is a good, they will get approval, FDA approval, likely taking over. I'm hoping for 10 bagger out of that, right? So, and then there's also other ideas. I mean, I can throw a few, couple if we have time. DeltaCast, DCTH, right? It's a cancer curing. It's for the liver, late stage liver cancer. I mean, to cut story short, 10 years ago, they went to FDA asking for approval. Market cap is 500 million. Mm-hmm. Right now it's 100 million. They're ahead of FDA. They're going to ask for approval again. Okay, they got approval in Europe, so very likely got approval. And then they just fully funded, just did the financing for a major fund, biotech fund. I mean, those people come in because they think they will get approved, right? Because they're going to hold for a while. If it's not approved, everything goes to zero. I mean, or very close to, right? So, so the chance of approval is very high. And right now, I think, you know, you can say 10 years ago was it's a bubble, 500 million, but 100 million is too cheap, right? It's likely to double from here, then you can take half off and then you don't take a risk into the approval. Like, at least, I think at least to 200 million. We'll see. So another ACHV, this one is DCTH, another ACHV with it's a smoke. It's a little one for the stopping smoke.
Oh, okay.
And they're going to have after all the hard work in the past few years, they're going to get the final readout for second phase 3. Will come out next quarter. They just finished the last enrollment. You can look at the chart, start picking up. Of course, my subscribers, I keep them when they were $2, $3 range, but now it's $6. But it's such a big market for the smoke. Stopping the smoke. So I think it can go much higher. Data will come out. I would recommend, you know, to sell some on the big pop on the data last time. I think go to double digit. I have no doubt it will go to double digit they are positive.
All right, Chen, what's the name of that one again?
ACHV. That's a little stock also in my newsletter. ACHV. It's a small biotech is in bull market because all the big pharma are using their COVID money to buy small biotech. Every week there's a buyout. So that's very exciting.
All right, very good. Well, let's leave it go at that, Chen. Thank you so much for sharing your insights, your thoughts, and it's great to have you again. We'll like to do it again sometime soon. Thank you.
Okay, great.
Again,
thank you,
Chen. Again, folks, it's chenpicks.com. to sign up for Chen's letter to get his insights. And he sends things out frequently. If there's some really important news that's going to be a driver for shares, he sends them out to his subscribers. So it's well worth the money. Thank you, Chen. All right. All right, folks, don't go away. We'll be right back with John Rubino, who will talk about this whole topic we're talking about today. That's petrodollar, the petrodollar's demise. We'll be right back with John Rubino. Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm here with John Rubino. He is the author of several books, in fact, very timely books, I might add, given what the subject of this show is today. And John is also a prolific writer, writing frequently now on Substack. And he, of course, is the founder of dollarcollapse.com, which he recently sold, I believe. And we're really happy, though, that he's here with us today. To talk about the subject of today, which is the petrodollar's demise and you. John, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Jay, good to be back. And congratulations on the new video venture. It's looking good.
Well, I think it's doing pretty well. I think so, yes. We're still learning and doing the best we can. But it's fun. It's actually good to see the people you're talking to and not just, you know, yap at them over the phone, as we did when we did the radio show. So the petrodollar's demise, and the idea is that people are less enthused about owning and trading in dollars as they once were. However, there's a lot of skeptics. I guess, you know, the dollar has been the world's reserve currency since World War II, essentially, I guess. But I saw this one quote from Javier Blas of Bloomberg. This was on February 27th, and he said the petro-yuan's demise, or he said the petrodollar's demise is a myth, and the petro-yuan's rise, it ain't going to happen, essentially, is what he said. And then on March 27th, you wrote an article on Substack that was titled De-Dollarization Just Got Real. So there's a disconnect there between the Bloomberg author and yourself. What makes you think that all of a sudden, or maybe it's not all of a sudden, but that the dollar's rise or the dollar's demise is real?
Well, the dollar's demise is probably too strong a term, because, you know, the dollar is a reserve currency. It's going to be around. We have deep liquid capital markets that will make the dollar useful for trade for quite a while going forward. But what's happening now is the dollar's dominance is being challenged. It's getting some competition. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of an all of a sudden thing, because the BRICS countries that you hear that term a
sure.
lot. And that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and South Africa. And they've been kind of this informal group really since like 2007 or so. And nothing really came of it. You know, they bought a lot of gold, and they had some rhetorical arguments with the U.S., but they didn't end up supplanting the dollar or even really, you know, taking any serious steps in that direction. That kind of sort of changed just lately, where they announced that they were going to form a currency union. And it was going to be a currency based on their currencies and the gold that they own and everything. And that it would be a competitor with the dollar. It would be used for trade among the BRICS countries. Well, that's cool, but it's still not a major challenge for the dollar. But then a bunch of other countries started applying for membership to the BRICS coalition. And it's serious countries. It's Saudi Arabia and yep. Mexico and Iran and Turkey and the UAE and Egypt. So, you know, you put those guys together with the BRICS countries and you've got like half the human race there. So if they are able to kind of herd that group of cats into a real coalition that cooperates, then they've got some considerable market power and are potentially able to create another currency that might work as a reserve currency alongside the dollar and the euro and the yen. And at the same time they're doing that, they're cutting bilateral trade deals with each other where they're trading with their own currencies, like China and Brazil now are going to trade in each other's currencies. And that's potentially a big deal because there's no real technical reason why that can't be done for all of their trade, just about. And with Saudi Arabia willing to take other currencies for their oil, that means the petrodollar is not a, you know, it's not the thing that it was, because it was based in the past on the fact that Saudi Arabia only took dollars in return for oil. So a lot is changing out there. And one of the big manifestations of that is that a lot of the countries in the BRICS coalition are commodity producers. And if you get a bunch of them together and cooperating, then they gain pricing power in the commodities markets. And we just saw an example of that on yesterday. Today's Monday, and yesterday on Sunday afternoon, the OPEC countries, especially Saudi Arabia and Russia, announced production cuts because they want oil to be more expensive. And you know, we woke up today and oil was $5 more. And they can do that, and they can get away with it in oil. But it's conceivable that they'll be able to get away with things like that in other commodities going forward. And that's very inflationary for the commodity consuming countries like the US. So we're seeing the dollar get some competition, which means the demand for dollars as a reserve currency might not be as high as it has been in the past, which means dollars are going to be sold, let's say, for yuan or rupees or rubles or whatever. Those dollars have to go somewhere. So they'll come back here. They'll bid up the price of U.S. assets, which is inflationary. And the selling pressure on the dollar will lower the exchange rate of the dollar, other things being equal, which is also inflationary. So the fact that other countries are controlling commodity pricing might be inflationary for the US. And that just adds to all the other problems we have. You know, we've got a ton of financial problems that's completely independent of the dollar's role in the world. We would have a gigantic financial crisis out there regardless. But this stuff with the BRICS and rising commodity inflation, yada, yada, those things add to the pressure on the US government and the dollar. Such that we'll get some kind of a currency crisis at some point in the future where people really don't want to hold dollars at the prevailing value just because we don't trust future inflation rates. We think it'll be inflated away. And we're staring at that regardless, but this whole thing with the BRICS and commodities brings that forward in time. It makes that eventuality something that's going to happen sooner than it would have otherwise.
There's no doubt that the most important commodity, I believe, or it's oil and maybe natural gas. And when you think about it, John, the alliance between Saudi Arabia and China and Russia, the BRICS, they have joined the BRICS or have applied to, at least Saudi Arabia has. They can pretty well, I mean, Russia with its ability to produce oil. The United States doesn't have much of a presence anymore in the Middle East. And the Saudi Arabia now going in the other direction, they can almost form their cartel and call their price for oil, much as the United States was able to do, essentially as OPEC was able to do when it was in, when it was in alliance with the United States. So this is pretty ominous, I think, for the United States.
Yeah, well, it's one more problem among many for the United States because we're screwing up on so many different levels that it's almost hard to pick out one and focus on it because there's so many other things that we're doing wrong. I mean, look at how much debt we're taking on. You know, what did we have? Something like $7 trillion of debt before the past crisis in 2008, 2009. Now we're up to $31 trillion and rising at an accelerating rate. So that's the kind of thing that just right there will blow up a system. And if you add all the other stuff that we have, you know, the geopolitics and the global currency issues and stuff like that, it means that there's a currency reset out there that's going to be forced upon us by the market at some point. And it might be sooner rather than later if all of this stuff comes to a head. Because remember what happened with the banks just lately here, just since you and I talked last.
Yeah,
we had a near death experience for the banking system here in the US, where a couple of minor banks imploded, and that was going to take down the rest of the regional and local banks because of what interest rates going up did to their balance sheets. You know, this came out of the blue. It was like Thursday, Silicon Valley Bank was okay. Friday, it was bankrupt in liquidation. And that almost happened just a couple of weeks ago. And now we've got commercial real estate that's kind of in the same boat as regional banks are, because basically a ton of office buildings and strip malls and warehouses and things got built in the last 10 years with that incredibly easy money that we had.
Right.
So they were built and financed with extremely low interest rates. But now a lot of that debt has to be rolled over. There's something like $3 trillion has to be rolled over in the next 5 years on a kind of a rolling basis. And that puts those guys in the same boat as a lot of the banks that almost got into trouble, where they have to roll their debts over at higher rates, which means their assets no longer cover necessarily the cost of the new higher interest rates they have to pay. And so they become insolvent. And this is happening while, you know, office vacancy rates are going up for reasons that have nothing to do with any kind of financing or anything. And the economy is slowing down. And, you know, there's a map of Amazon's activities with their warehouses, where they're closing the warehouse here and mothballing one there and delaying the creation of one over here. And it's all over the country. There's dozens of dots on that map where warehouses are being closed or mothballed or whatever. Wow. So there's a ton of real estate that is in trouble going forward. And that might be the next big thing. You know, that might be the thing that blows up on us next.
Yeah.
And it might pull the local and regional banks, which own a lot of real estate or own a lot of loans on real estate, back into the crisis. So they're not out of the woods yet. And the next crisis is coming, and the government's going to have to decide whether to bail them out, you know. So that has nothing to do with the dollar. That's just us screwing around with the local economy and making horrendous mistakes.
Right. So all this zero-based interest rates or very low interest rates have kept zombie companies alive since 2008, 2009. We never really allowed the system to be cleansed after 2008, 2009, pumped huge amounts of money, created huge amounts of debt. And here we are, once you allow the market to start determining the price of interest, the interest rates or what the cost of capital is, all of a sudden these companies that were subsidized, kept on life support essentially by the Federal Reserve, pumping money into the system, keeping the interest rates low, all of a sudden are no longer viable. And I have to ask you, John, I don't know if you've heard of this. We've been basically on a LIBOR system in the past, that it's going to something called SOFR. I've had a guest on my show talk extensively about that. And that the LIBOR was, you know, is basically an interest rate that is derived by about 20 different banks around the world that just sort of set the price a little bit like they set the gold price. And in London, you know, the London PM fix or whatever, AM and PM fix is, you know, a bunch of guys get together, four or five banks, and decide what the price is. So far as I understand it, has derived out of the New York Fed, and that Powell is very much behind it. And that, as a matter of fact, it is a more market-driven cost of interest. So this one guest of mine is suggesting that that's the direction we're going, and that Powell has no intent on pivoting anytime soon. I just throw that out there for whatever you might think about that notion or that idea.
Well, we've had the idea for a long time that the Fed was going to tighten until it breaks something.
Yeah.
And it looked over the last few weeks like they did break the part of the banking system. But they papered that over by guaranteeing every deposit in every bank across the country. So now that's not an immediate crisis, but I think that you're right. The central banks of the world in general want to keep tightening until they're sure inflation is no longer a problem, because that was an existential threat.
Yeah.
2022's inflation would basically blow up a fiat currency system if it was allowed to continue. Right. So they know they can't let that happen, but they know they're in danger of blowing up big sectors of the economy if they keep raising interest rates. So that's the dilemma that they were always going to find themselves in.
Mm-hmm.
And they have. They are in that box now that there's no way out of. So if they go back to easing so that real estate and the banks, et cetera, don't implode, then they reignite inflation, which will blow up the currency eventually. But if they keep tightening, they're going to cause big sectors of the economy to implode, which will force them to do big bailouts, and they'll be back to easing again. You know, so there's no way out of this at this point. And, you know, this whole thing, though, Jay, is great for gold. And what nobody seems to have noticed this week, it just happened in such a low-key way, is that gold set a record for the highest monthly and quarterly close ever.
Yeah.
And
well, that's true. As a matter of fact, John, I look at the average daily cost, the average daily price of gold as the PM fix in London. And I noticed that if the first couple of days of this month hold, it will be a new average, monthly average high ever for gold as well. So it's not just a close, but the average price of gold. So we'll see where it's at. But it certainly seems bullish. And just getting to the mechanics of how we might be heading back towards a gold-backed monetary system, at least in the Asia environment. It's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the Shanghai exchange has it's a futures exchange for gold, and it also has a futures exchange for oil. So in theory, Saudi Arabia could sell its oil to China for yuan, and then take its yuan and buy gold. And so not have a paper currency, but secure its, you know, exchange oil for another commodity, gold, for a monetary commodity, gold. Is that your understanding?
Jay, that is absolutely right, and it's potentially huge. Because think about this: if you're you're Russia and you're now trading with China and India in their currencies, mm-hmm. you're accumulating a bunch of rupees and yuan, which up to a point you're happy to have, so you can use those things to buy stuff from those other countries.
Right.
But beyond a certain point, you don't want too many yuan or too many rupees because they're not legit reserve currencies yet.
Yeah.
So what do? You're not going to switch back into dollars because you really don't want the U.S. to have power over you anymore. You want to be out of dollars. So the logical thing is to swap some rupees and some yuan for gold. So you start accumulating gold as part of this de-dollarization process, even though that might not have been the original goal to help you buy a lot more gold, but it's the logical thing to do as you're accumulating these lesser currencies. So I think a lot of these guys just, without thinking ahead to a future gold standard necessarily, will be accumulating gold just because it's a logical thing to do with the currency flows that they're now seeing. So their foreign exchange reserves will become more and more gold centric over time, which makes it easier and easier for them to consider linking their currencies in some way to gold. So we could kind of back our way into a gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with de-dollarization, and that's already happening. So I think it's kind of a logical progression where a few years from now, these guys end up owning a lot more gold than they do today.
Mm-hmm. You know, you have countries that are producing commodities, as you suggested, the BRICS countries tend to be commodity producers. America has given up its commodity production to a very great extent, make it very difficult for mining, for manufacturing, for even establishing refineries, oil and gas, refineries and so forth, because of the green attitude, the environmental lobby, whatever, here. We are no producers anymore. We produce paper money, which we've used to buy goods from the rest of the world. But you have to live with commodities. You got to have commodities to stay alive. You have to have energy. You have to have food. You have to have these things. So the United States might be in a position where we already are to a great extent with China, where we're looking, we're so dependent on China for so many things now. We're going to have to start producing those things at home, I would think, John. In order to do that, though, capital has to be treated well when it goes into those sectors. So do you think that, that maybe at some point we might find, let's say that Asia starts to really thrive on some sort of a quasi gold standard where they're actually, their currencies are rewarded for the production that they make, not just because they're creating them out of, creating money out of thin air as we have, but they actually produce stuff that give their currencies value, intrinsic value in a sense, that we might be in a position in the United States where we have to get gold. Our government's going to say we have to have more gold to back up the currency, which leads me then to a question I'd like to get your opinion on. Roosevelt set the precedent, confiscated gold, or actually paid, I guess, $28 and change per ounce of gold, and then raised it to 35. Could we be in a position again, John, in your view, where the United States government, out of necessity, might say, uh-oh, yeah, we really do need that barbaric relic. We need that as a means of just surviving in the world.
Oh, I think that's going to be true of everybody. Because, you know, our currencies are going to be less and less functional over time. Different currencies at a different rate. They'll all lose value as long as they're fiat currencies. Just because if a government has a printing press, they will abuse that power. Mm-hmm. Because there's always so many needs that are just immediate for governments. They need to steal the next election. They need to invade somebody right away. Various things like that will always take precedence over short-term inflation. So however this plays out, whoever has whatever resources, they are all going to want gold going forward. And, you know, there's so little gold out there that's available and so much potential demand that I think the time will come when you get kind of a panic, when you get panic buying as everybody tries to get through this one door and they don't fit. So that day is out there when gold goes parabolic because everybody's panicking and trying to buy it. And the stuff we're talking about today, those processes are the kind of things that contribute to the overall process of people realizing they need more gold. So I think the central banks of the world are going to be net buyers for the indefinite future. And I think a lot of trade is going to end with gold, where you do a deal in a certain currency and then you swap that currency immediately on the Shanghai Gold Exchange or wherever, and then take your gold home with you and store it, because that's real money that you don't have to worry about. So the dynamics are all kind of in place, and that's just a question of timing. How long will it take for this to become a really visible part of the system where you're seeing a lot of gold being taken off the exchanges by traders and by central banks, and that starts a buying panic? So I think the time is coming, and I think we want to be there when it happens. So it's a really good environment for physical precious metals and for the best quality miners. You know, if you've got some of the big streaming companies or whatever, they're going to do great in this environment. And if you've got the highest quality juniors and exploration companies, they're lottery tickets in this kind of an environment. So you see them not only succeeding operationally, but the demand for their kind of thing conceptually going way up too. So there's 10 baggers out there, Jay. A lot of them are in your newsletter.
Yes, John, you and I know a lot of them. Newfound Gold, for example, Snowline, a little one called Irving. I found my friend Chen Lin is going to be traveling to Japan to visit that company. I had the invitation to do it as well, but couldn't find the time. But yeah, these are stories that are very, very exciting. And I might just say, you know, I mentioned the idea of confiscation of gold. That doesn't mean that people shouldn't be keeping their gold now, because even going back to the 30s, if it were to happen again, at least you were given value in currency for that gold. It wasn't as if the government just stole it from you. And we pray to God that would never happen in America, but you never can say never, I suppose. But the point is, what happened then, people ran to the gold mining shares. They took the money they got for the sale of their gold to the government and went out and bought Homestake, or some of the Canadians were, you know, and they were just enormously profitable with huge dividends. And, you know, I think when the Dow went down something like 90% in the 30s, 89%, you know, gold went up several, like Homestake went up five or six fold during that time frame, plus dividends. It was amazing. And some of the Canadians did even better. So nobody knows what the future holds. But I would suggest that owning gold in different ways is a good thing to do, John. Not just, you start with physical gold in your possession. That's probably the safest. But then there's other ways to own it as well. And one way is, as you say, in the gold shares. And and the major mining companies, John, from my understanding, you can correct me if you have a different view of it, they have really done very well and in not wasting money this time. They've gone out in the past and purchased juniors sort of foolishly, just to sort of expand their, make sure they kept their production up and they could keep their nice jobs and so forth. They went out, paid too much for some of the juniors. This time, the majors are keeping their balance sheets very clean, as I understand it. I don't know if you
have. Yeah. Yeah, they overpaid and they tried to build empires in the last cycle, and they paid a big financial and reputational price for getting too excited. So now they don't want to make that mistake again. Yeah. But here's how human nature works. You know, you've been burned by something in the past, so you're reluctant to engage in the same kind of stuff going forward. But you're still, you're cautious, you know, you do things and they work out because you were cautious and you make productive investments and they succeed and you feel a little bit smarter and then you do a few more and so on. And then you feel like a genius because you've been cautious and you've done productive things. And that, you know, the potential to double or triple from here, you know, to go back to building that empire becomes overwhelming.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just going to take longer for the major miners to start being aggressive again. But I think they will be at some point, just because there's a limited number of juniors who can move the needle for, you know, a Newmont or somebody like that. And once one or two of them get snapped up, then whoever hasn't snapped one up is going to have to get one of their own, right? And they're going to have to pay whatever they have to pay at that point. And that's when you want to be owning the junior stocks and be handing them back off to the investors who are betting on a gigantic takeover. So that'll still come. There will still be a buying frenzy in this market. It's just going to take a while because the today's CEOs were burned by that in the recent past. Yeah. And it's going to take them a while to get over that reticence, but it'll still come. There will still be bidding wars for the very best exploration companies.
Well, when the price of gold gets to the level that's necessary to make the numbers work, to make the economics work, they'll be there, no doubt about it, John. I want to thank you so much for spending your time. Any last word? Any last word of knowledge for our listeners?
Well, yeah, there's, we talk about a lot of gloom and doom stuff on here, Jay, and I want to make the point that that gloom and doomy, oh, the world's coming to an end stuff, is just in service of an investment thesis. In other words, we're trying to make money, so we're trying to make our lives better by choosing the right mining stock or which precious metal held in which place. You know, we're doing things that in the world that's coming ought to protect us and maybe make us a lot of money. And it's really helpful psychologically to keep that part in mind. You know, keep your eyes on the prize, which is big winners, and don't worry about the stuff you can't change. You know, geopolitics and government finances, we can't fix that. No. But we can position ourselves so that their mistakes become our opportunities. And that's how we should be approaching this stuff.
Right. Very good. Very good advice. Turning negatives into positives. John, thank you so much. Good to have you with us, and we'll do it again sometime, hopefully very soon.
Great. Thanks, Jay.
All right. Well, folks, don't go away. Frank Holmes will be with me in just a moment. Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm pleased to have Frank Holmes with me once again. Frank has been the CEO and Chief Investment Officer of U.S. Global Investors since he bought the firm, well, he bought controlling interest anyway, back in 1989. U.S. Global Investors trades on NASDAQ. Its symbol is GROW. And I've known Frank and have known of the fund for quite a few years for its gold mutual funds, but more recently, it has created some ETFs that are very interesting, and we might get into that a little bit later when we talk to Frank. Frank, thank you so much for joining me again.
It's great to be with you, Jay.
You know, we've titled the show The Petrodollar's Demise and You. We're hearing more and more about this. I've been talking to Alistair MacLeod over the years about it. He saw it coming, but it's, you know, and people started saying, hey, what are you talking about, Alistair? You've been talking about this for years and years, but now it seems to really be sort of taking hold. What are your thoughts, Frank? Do you think we're close to a major change, or is this just something that's going to take many years to unfold?
No, I think in the next couple of years, it's going to unfold, but it's going to accelerate now. And I think there's, you know, many issues and many positions. What I try to tell investors is that today you have to go to decentralized news media. Centralized, you know, sadly enough, Bloomberg has become very much like that centralized news network.
Yeah.
And it's understanding. So, and then you have to be able to arbitrage truth. You know, truth has three different views to it. But like we arbitrage a stock valuation between one and the other, you have to really be clever about trying to arbitrage information. But when we talk about petrodollars, you make me feel young. I'm 68, and yeah. I remember my first paper in university in world economics in 76. It was on petrodollars, and it was the significance of the recycling of the petrodollars, because in the 70s we had the energy crisis, and the hardcore deal cut with the Saudis was that they would, if we're going to have to buy this oil, that it's all going to be in US dollars. And then they would turn around and buy jets from us, and they became a big military force. And we promised that we would set up military bases throughout the Middle East and Africa that would protect them and protect mm-hmm. the kingdom. And America's done that. And so we've come along, and the recycling petrodollars has been remarkable how it's continued to flourish the world. But some of the actions last year were perceived as we're not going to protect the Saudis. Mm-hmm. And so with that in particular was, I was told now, it was their interpretation of how we pulled out of Afghanistan. And therefore it was so abrupt, and it breached that trust. And all along, and I know this for over 5 years ago, and it started 10 years ago, the Chinese have been trying to negotiate with the Saudis to buy the oil, because sure. Because the Chinese are 50% of all commodity demand. They're the biggest oil importer. Mm-hmm. So they want them to take renminbi. Now, before, they were taking dollars. And then they would turn around and buy caterpillars from America. They would buy engineering work from America. Now, all of a sudden, they're willing to take renminbi.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't trust the currency a decade ago, and even 5 years ago, because they said there wasn't enough gold behind it. So what did you see China do? China focused on expanding its own gold operations. It became the biggest gold producer in the world, and they bought every ounce of it. Then they went on the open market and they bought. And after the 08 crash, we had like two waves of it. They basically took control of the gold market, that they stopped becoming price takers. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be price makers in Shanghai.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they've increased their gold exposure, and the real tipping point took place in December when it was announced that they had much more gold than expected, and Saudis were now willing to take renminbi. And since then, we're in the announcement that the Saudi oil company, Aramco, is buying a big position in the Chinese refinery, mm-hmm. that they're also going to build a big refinery in Saudi Arabia. So they're going to recycle petrol dollars. They're not going to be recycling U.S. dollars. It's going to be recycling to China. That will hurt high-end job creation in America.
Sure, sure.
And they want to build their own jets, so they don't have to buy Airbus or Boeing.
Sure.
When will that happen? I don't know, but it's in the cards, just sure. like they copy the Caterpillar.
Sure.
So it is a real issue of, and what we could, the concern is that the interest rates won't be able to rise much more above 4%. It's like where ice melts at 30, yep. at 33 degrees Fahrenheit, it melts.
Yeah.
At 32, you got ice. 33, yep. it melts. And as soon as you went above 4% interest rates, everyone bolted to put higher yield money. So what's inflation running at? Well, inflation, they say, is 6%, 7%. But really, as you know, looking at shadow statistics, it's running 14%.
Right.
But they can't raise it like Volcker did. If they want to really stop inflation, they'd have to take it to 20%.
Yeah.
It would implode.
And they can't, Frank, they can't do that because the debt load is just simply too great now.
Well, that's just another government factor. But they would, all the banks would go bankrupt overnight.
Right.
And so it's a very fine line. And so that's what we're witnessing in these markets. So the administration of the Saudis, the Qatars, et cetera, they're losing confidence in America's administration. But I don't know if it's really a battle against the politicians of America and the Saudi kingdom, or is it the regulatory agencies? And the agencies last a lot longer than presidents do. I mean, a congressperson's has got 2 years,
right?
And these, we saw what happened with Fauci. He was there for 4 decades.
Yes.
And so you're seeing that, and what I've seen is now they're going after Trump. They're indicting Trump. But they blamed Trump before was all on Russia. And strange enough, they go after Biden on Russia. So that means there's another political force that is anti-Russia because they're going after both presidents.
Right.
It's not Democrats versus Republicans. It has both are getting tagged with this.
Right.
And
where's that force coming from, Frank?
Well, that's what a lot of people believe. It's the Beltway Party. Yeah. And I share you a story that always resonates with me. Just after Bernanke retired, I was at SkyBridge conference in a hedge fund conference in Vegas, and he was a keynote speaker. And he talked about that, asked about how long do you think Trump who's going to win the election? Still, Trump had not come to power. And he said he thinks that Trump will win, but he'll be a one-term president.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, why? And he said, because he's like Jimmy Carter. And everyone was shocked. And he was asked to explain, like, how could you ever say that Trump is like Jimmy Carter? And he said, it doesn't really matter if it's a Democrat or Republican. Once you go after big, powerful bureaucrats and government agencies, they become a partnership with lobbyists and they go after you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they did to Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they'll do to Trump, because Trump keeps saying, drain the swamp, drain the swamp.
Right, right,
right. So if that's true, I don't know. But I thought, for me, I never looked at it that way. I never had that perspective.
Yeah.
But after listening to Bernanke, it's interesting to see how it's evolved since then.
Yeah.
And so Trump was a one-term president, and now he's going through the first president to be indicted this way.
Yeah.
I how long will unfold? But that,
well, Frank, let me just say that what you just said about the swamp makes sense, because in talking to Jeff Dice, who is Ron Paul's chief of staff, Jeff said, Jay, you don't realize that any one of these big bureaucracies is more powerful than the president. So I think that's exactly just...
maybe that's what Bernanke meant. And thank you for adding that color to it. So it creates this tension, and this agencies feel they can overreach. Every agent feels they can overreach.
Mm-hmm.
And how fast America froze $350 billion of Russian assets, and then went after the oligarchs, made the BRICS countries concerned that these agencies will do that to them.
Right. And so, Frank, do you think that the Saudis backed away from the U.S. after Afghanistan because they just didn't feel they could be confident that the U.S. would have their backs in the future? Or were there other factors, such as the United States going green and saying, we don't want hydrocarbons anymore? At the same time, that China is saying, heck yes, we want hydrocarbons. We're going to grow. We're going to build our country.
I think there's no doubt there's that combination.
Right.
And what always amazes me is that they have concentration camps in western part of China for Muslims.
Right.
But for some odd reason, the Saudis and the Iranians now, they just did that incredible diplomatic negotiating that the Saudis stopped fighting with the Iranians. And then they go to Russia. She goes to Russia. And now he makes this announcement this week, according to geopolitical policy, that he's getting ready for war. What war? Best-selling book out there in the technology space is The Chip War. Well, yeah. The high-end chips, the GPU chips, I know about buying these from NVIDIA for high blockchain. The high-end come from Taiwan. Mm-hmm. So they invade Taiwan. 80% of the high-quality chips come from there. How would that disrupt the supply lines? What would that do to the world? And then they come with the policies to turn around and fund chip manufacturing in the U.S., but it has all these union attachments mm-hmm. to it.
Right.
And so that money really isn't about building facilities to be independent. It's much more of a social investment. And so I think it's interesting. I just believe, Jay, that there is always going to be imbalances between the fiscal policymakers and the monetary policymakers. Uh-huh. And gold is always a critical element of being the ballast or the dagger board if you've got a little sailboat. So the boat doesn't tip over. Yeah. And you've got to rebalance that and make sure. And the biggest hedge fund in the world, Ray Dalio, he is always a 10% to 25% weighting gold in a parity trade. And he recognizes that. Yeah. So it's not so much as a Democrats versus Republicans. No, that's not the issue. The issue is the imbalance of their policies.
Right.
And now what America is wrestling with is an imbalance in their domestic policies. And for the first time ever, fighting two cold wars at the same time, an imbalance in the global scene.
Yeah.
And so that is how we navigate through these waters, makes it that you should have these non-diversified assets. And look at gold. I mean, central banks have been buying gold. Canada sold all their gold because back in the early 90s, late 80s, in that time period, because they said they could earn interest and they're smarter earning interest on their money because gold didn't pay anything.
Yeah.
But last year we have rates surging. Why would they all of a sudden, Canada didn't buy, but other countries kept buying gold.
Right.
Interest rates are rising because something else is happening geopolitically.
Yeah.
And there's an imbalance geopolitically. So now we have the Russians invade Ukraine. We freeze their assets. Mm-hmm. That makes Brazil get worried. That makes other nations around the world become concerned of overreaching U.S. policymakers. Mm-hmm. And so now they're thinking of forming, which they're in the process of, their own currency.
Right.
And you Frank,
you were one of the first people to talk about the BRICS, as I recall.
Yes.
You might have even named them the BRICS. So you might have been the guy that gave the name. I don't know. It's sort of
at least. No. That was a Goldman Sachs.
Okay. I'm giving credit to the wrong guy.
Sort of England. But it was looking at, predominantly at population and seeing that in 2001, World Trade Organization, the open up of global trade, that these nations are going to become very important for the movement of commodities and the manufacturing of a finished product, mm-hmm. especially at the bottom half of the food chain. Mm-hmm. America, Germany, and Europe are manufacturing things at the top half of the food chain. China is doing everything. Now, China's GDP, we have to remember, it took off. So gold took off. I try to remember, I told you, the love trade.
Yes.
60% of gold is related to the GDP per capita of China and India. They're 40% of the world's population. So we have to be really sensitive. Coming back to Kissinger mm-hmm. warned Trump, and I think he also warned Biden, stop attacking the Chinese. If anything, you should partner with the Russians. Mm-hmm. Find a way of having some diplomacy because you're going to need Russia to fight the Chinese.
Right. Yeah, but we've done the opposite. And I know David Stockman on this show, about the time that President Biden started talking about sanctions, and he says, don't do that. That's crazy as hell. It's going to hurt the United States as much as it hurts Russia. And I think it's proven to be true so far. I mean, look at what's happened. The supply chains and the disruptions of international trade, Frank, you know as well as anybody, because that's at least one of your ETFs tracks that sort of thing, right?
Right. But I think Kissinger was probably speaking to the wrong audience. It wasn't the executive office of the branch of a policy who run the fiscal policies of the country,
the
monetary policies of the Federal Reserve.
Right.
And so there are these imbalances of tax collection for all the spending. Mm-hmm. And that's where it means the money printing has to take place.
Right.
We did see money supply contracting. What people didn't expect were these digital apps and how fast people started to move money when interest rates went above 4%.
Right.
It came a tipping point.
Right.
And all these, and what I, as running bond funds and in our funds, we have a strategy that you have A or B strategy. A strategy is called laddering. So if you had $10 million, you put $1 million for each year going out 10 years. Mm-hmm. Other one is called barbelling. You put $5 million out for 10 years and $5 million for 1 year. So your average is five and a half. So you're mm-hmm. in that middle. Mm-hmm. That requires much bigger guts to be able to maneuver. And when you barbell, you have to be able to pivot when there's a big change in interest rates sure. and policies change.
Right.
These young bankers and portfolio managers were running a barbell to get yield, but they didn't know about pivoting. And so they all got caught offside, looking for yield. And that imbalance is hundreds of billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you estimate them, all the banks, et cetera, it's something like $1.2 trillion imbalance. And with the mark to market rule and the interpretation, it creates more stress.
Right.
And this mark-to-market rulemaking, if you recall, it was going to come out in 2007.
Right,
they delayed it to 2008, and that immediately dried up commercial paper. Bear Stearns goes bankrupt,
right.
and then Lehman goes under, and then Obama becomes the president, and Shapiro becomes the head of the SEC. And immediately, they repeal the mark-to-market rulemaking. Because of the severity of the auditors interpreting it. Mm-hmm. Well, that helped the markets open up. I remember recommending, and I put $1 million into my homes fund, and I was very public about it,
yeah.
that government policies are going to spend $900 billion and for public companies, and they're going to take away the mark-to-market, and the market took off.
Yeah. I remember doing that, Frank.
They brought it back, and Warren Buffett's complained about it. And Warren Buffett had his first big paper loss. And he said, companies should focus on the operating earnings, not the net earnings, because right. the mark-to-market is too volatile.
Right, right.
And so we're wrestling with these imbalances. And mm-hmm. you know, it's just human nature. It's not that the government, it's not one political party is better than the other, one agency. Is it a smart person wants to play Switzerland?
Yeah.
I want to be neutral. But to be that, I have to own gold. And when I was in Switzerland last week and hearing small banks with $5 billion all of a sudden have $3 billion in bullion.
Yeah.
And they move from $2 billion up to $3 billion of the concerns of Xi and his statements going to see Putin, the petrodollar scare. So we are seeing this week, $5 billion went into the GDL. And so we are seeing money all of a sudden going into bullion. We are seeing a peak in interest rates. And when I did my interview on CNBC, I said rates are peaking or they're going to peak this next quarter mm-hmm. and fall. And they're going to be negative. So anytime interest rates stay negative, it's very bullish for gold. And the policymakers can't raise rates without a financial crisis.
Frank, are you talking about negative nominal rates?
Yes.
I mean, because they've not been positive on a real basis in the U.S., at least for certainly negative couple percent yet, even now, right?
Oh, it's even bigger.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's you look at 10-year money versus inflationary rate, 5-year money, it's all negative. But if you look at the old, and they just changed the CPI algorithm again.
Oh, okay.
Didn't know. And if you looked at the algorithm that Paul Volcker had to use in 1980, if you use that algorithm, inflation's 14%, Jay.
Is that right? Now, that's what it would be. If you used the same yardstick now as we did back in 1980, that's incredible. Right. And it's squeezing the middle class like there's no tomorrow. It really
Correct.
Is. Yeah. Well, Frank, getting back to this petrodollar thing, this is big. I mean, I'm looking at the number of countries around the world who are saying, we're not going to use dollars anymore. You mentioned Saudi Arabia, Brazil, China, even little countries.
India too.
India is big. India and I see Tanzania or somebody like that has said we're going to trade without dollars. Saudi Arabia mentioned that's the big one. The BRICS, and Iran, the Venezuela. These are countries that are they don't want the dollars. Is it a certain amount of anger? I think a lot of people, a lot of countries, rightly or wrongly, believe the U.S. have abused their privilege, used their power to drive the military to make changes in governments to do whatever. In order to benefit, and you know, you could, if you try to look at it from their side, it's sometimes it's easy. You might understand that maybe everything we're hearing isn't exactly right. It's propaganda.
Well, I don't like I say I don't know. I just listen to and try to triangulate all these opinions and
right.
And I try to tell the older friends of mine, the analysts, etc., that they should be looking at Twitter and they should look at Reddit. Because there's a brand new audience of how people invest and trade. It's not just the crypto ecosystem. Yeah. And that's something else. The crypto ecosystem is being attacked by the banks. There is the law firm of Cooper and Kirk wrote this piece that they've gone before the Supreme Court when the various agencies collude together. And so you sit there and you say, well, why am I starting to see on Twitter more and more about the confiscation of gold in 1933? And a year ago, I was seeing many articles and they come in flurries about the concern of Credit Suisse Bank. So you see people make statements and then they have charts and they have visuals and your ability is not a black and white decision. It's always very gray and you're arbitraging it. But a year later, they're bankrupt.
Yeah.
Well, so why are they putting these proclamations out that you had to surrender your gold in 1933?
Correct.
And the concern that the crypto ecosystem has is that they'll do that against gold. They're trying to do that against Bitcoin. And the Chinese, which I learned in Zurich, by the way, the Chinese, you can't go there today. A Glencore trader was telling me, and use MasterCard, American Express, or Visa. They've already had the currency controls. You have to convert your money into WePay, WeChat, they don't have WhatsApp, they don't have Facebook, they don't have Yahoo, they don't have Google, and they're controlling all the information flow, and they're controlling. So you have your money, your bank's wired, the money goes into, you open up your account at WePay, and when you go over, you use your iPhone to pay for everything.
Yeah. Well, that's my understanding as well. I have a Chinese friend.
So what do? They got rid of American Express, MasterCard, Visa, and Bitcoin, anything, and they have their own digital currency, and they're backing more and more by gold to get deals done with the Saudis. So it is a big change. The other thing that's really important is that China is 10 times the size of GDP to Russia. Wow. One's 18 trillion, one's 1.8. They both have about the same GDP per capita, around 12,000. But to me, what's interesting in that is that everyone expected, and I think the policymakers thought, and with good intentions in America, honestly, we'll freeze the assets and we'll stop Russia from having any access. We'll go after all the oligarchs. Well, they didn't have, if they did this before, they do have today, China. So China partners. And China all of a sudden does all the trade between Russia and China. Chinese-Russian trade has gone up. So they're able to keep Russia alive in the war in Ukraine.
Right.
So we keep using our tax dollars to send equipment to fight, to help the Ukraine, which is a good moral cause. But, it's an unending fight because you're really fighting the engine of China.
Right.
Now, if you're a game theory guy, China sits there and says, I'm going to support Russia because if Russia wins, then I take over Taiwan.
Right.
If Russia loses, then I'm going to go up to Manchuria and I'm going to take all that land that used to be Chinese before back from Russia because Russia's going to be weak.
Uh-huh. Well, that's
so China wins. It's a double win. Doesn't matter.
Nothing to lose there, either one way or the other.
And the worry we all should have is the copper assets, they're now controlling copper stocks that are in the Congo. They're very big in all of Latin America. There's lots of people telling me that in that circle that I hear in Europe, money goes to NGOs that comes from the KGB. I've heard that before, and I've talked about that, but it's coming from China and it goes into Latin America. And how could you have such a sweep of left-wing governments?
Yeah.
And so the money's coming from Russia through Cuba and Venezuela, and it's coming through China, and China's doing all these contracts in Latin America.
Yes.
So they will control a lot of the strategic minerals. And so I think that anything that we have in North America, the strategic, and this past week, I don't know if you follow, but how bellicose the president of Mexico has been towards America.
Yes, yes.
Yes, I mean, what's that all neighbor, about? Yeah, yeah.
What's like, that all about?
Well, it's accusing America for what you said of overreaching, and who's knocking on the door of the Chinese?
Well, it seems to me the world is starting to recognize that China is really an ascending power, and they want to be on the winning side. A lot of these countries, perhaps, and they, if they see weakness in the current administration in Afghanistan and elsewhere. I don't know. But here's the thing.
I have a different theory on that. Okay. I just think that they're more corrupt, and it's easier to be corrupt with a Chinese and Chinese corporation than it is a North American or British corporation. Mm-hmm. There's rules of corruption, but it's pretty easy in that Chinese world. And so it's very easy for them to pay premiums to A, B, and C to be able to get X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, and if you take a look at, you know, one of the great saving graces of our nation and Canada, and I look at Singapore and Hong Kong before the Chinese took over, was all based on common law. No common law country's ever gone bankrupt. Common law countries, it's a different model, but the Chinese are civil law. And the Chinese are cutting deals wherever there's dictators or communist leaders and socialist leaders. And it's a civil law mindset. So rule of law and the concept of rule of law is very different than what we have from came out of the Magna Carta from the British.
Sure. Yeah.
We have a different way of it, but we have a more balanced way of regulating law. And so I think that it's easier for the Chinese to go in and deal in these nations because they're civil law.
Right. Well, Frank, let me ask you this, though. We have, for the longest time, we could get away as a nation with living beyond our means because we had other countries, net export countries, that were willing to buy our treasuries. They've pretty much gone away now. The Chinese are continuing to wind down their dollar holdings of treasuries. The Russians are, well, what about the Saudis? They were big buyers of U.S. dollars in the past. We recycled the petrodollar, and they would buy our treasuries. We ran ourselves into huge debt. In the meantime, the Chinese were running these massive trade surpluses, building up foreign currencies. Now they take those foreign currencies, the dollars, and they're using them to build up infrastructure, the one bridge, one road, New Silk Road, or as you say, through Africa and even into Latin America. And so it seems to me that we've gotten ourselves into, we've weakened ourselves geopolitically because of our economics. We've lived beyond our means. And we've gotten rid of the high value added jobs and manufacturing to a great extent. We still have Caterpillar, we have some things, but to a great extent, we've gotten rid of a lot of the really wealth creating industries, and we've lived pretty much as a consumer society. Do you agree with any of that? And so that we're in our—
Well, to a certain degree, I wouldn't be so harsh on this great nation. I really wouldn't be that harsh. I think Larry Summers, every year I spend a week with Guys Our Vintage, and it's 180 CEOs, and we pay kids and we go to class at Harvard for a week.
Oh.
And we have to read case studies, et cetera. And this year is all about the great digital transformation. And we have a sort of fire chat with Larry Summers, and he said, you have to remember that America is 5% of the world's population, mm-hmm. but close to 25% of GDP.
Right.
And we also, when you take a look at Europe, that's a museum. Japan is an old age home. China's a prison. And so America still has 60% of all public companies.
Uh-huh.
So there's something we're doing right. Mm-hmm. I look at the education is so important. I think that a lot of the outsourcing that took place is because of the severity of unionism and strikes of Washington, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, especially Thatcher in the UK, and the unions in the workplace manufacturing have dropped over the years. It's only the federal government and some state governments that unions have grown dramatically as a percentage. So I think that that's a really important part of what took place of the outsourcing. But if you look at the GDP per capita, China's 12,000, Russia's 12,000, America's like 75,000 now. If you look at on those sort of that scale of GDP per capita, besides this bigger GDP, is education. And it really shocked me that everyone talks about in America how great Europe is for free education. Well, there's two things I like to always explain to them. Less people get a college degree in Europe than in America. They don't respect that it's free. Less people are educated. All these Saudis have gone to American schools. They've gone to the best schools in America. They go back with Americanism. And they go back with that winning spirit. They want to be on the winning team. They had the World Cup, and now Saudi Arabia wants the World Cup. So I think we've really planted great seeds in these countries. What we want to make sure is we don't hurt those seeds. We've neglected those seeds. And I think the fact that we have so many more people who are more educated. The other component is only about 10% of Europeans invest in the market. We're talking about almost 50% in America. So, so the idea of free markets and free capitalism, I think the big bad boogeyman that always worries me, and which I learned from the crypto ecosystem, is the World Economic Forum. And how this person is able in Australia to speak to the 20 prime ministers and presidents of the G20.
How do you explain that? Person?
Who's the head of the UN? No one can tell me. I ask quickly, who's the head of the UN? But they know Schwab, they know and they know World Economic Forum. He talks to them. He's also talking to regulators in America.
Yeah, exactly. How do you account for that, Frank?
I don't know. He's the guy that's pushing privacy rights. Shareholder rights are about private property rights. A public domain is about my my rights as a shareholder. Well, that's been overtaken by stakeholder rights.
Yes, they don't
put up the money, and that's a form of socialism.
Then
the argument of inclusion became, we have to have gender equality. We have a man and a woman, both 5 years in business. They should, and they both have the same skill set. They should be paid the same. That's fair. We do that in sports, you know. And we only want the best athletes, so we should be doing that. So the whole argument of inclusion, well, inclusion start to grow.
And
all these minorities start dictating special rights from the majority.
All
that is a distraction and is un-American.
Well, we've gone from equality to equity. So it doesn't matter if you produce anything, you need to have the same. Well, anyway, Frank, there's so many things we could talk about. We're running out of time pretty soon, all too soon.
Let me give you some positive news, Jay.
Well, it's good to hear. Thank you, Frank.
Back since you and I, before we were born, on the third year of a presidential election cycle, the market's up like 95% of the time. And when it's a Democrat president, it's 13%.
So
remember that, just the math of markets.
So we're getting to what I wanted to get to.
Now, last thing, I'm really, really bullish on gold stocks. 10 years ago, less than 20% of the 100 gold producers in the world I track, less than 20% had free cash flow yields. Today, it's 60%. There's better corporate governance on returns on invested capital. That means they can increase their dividends. That means they can do a whole set of things. So I remain very bullish on gold stocks. And we've seen that in our GoAU ETF, how it's taken off, even with the royalty companies. People say, oh, royalty companies are slow to adopt. It's not true. It's been a leader. And so I think that the investors are and the junior gold mining sector went above the 50-day moving average. Historically, in March, they're down. Gold's down in March. Gold's up this March. So I'm really getting bullish about the gold stocks.
Well, I think you're right about the majors, the big guys, the big producers have been very much more disciplined. in running their companies than they have been in the past. And I think that will feed to the lower, the good little juniors that are finding massive amounts of gold in the ground should also feed off of that. Well, just sort of in summary here, Frank, so I take it you believe that probably interest rates have pretty much peaked. We're going to see longer 10 years, can't go above 4%, 3.5 now, more or less. I think that's what I'm hearing from you. You're, as you just said, extremely bullish on gold and silver. Commodities in general this year?
I think there'll be rotation. I think silver probably has the biggest upside because mm-hmm. of the industrial demand for solar panels with this $1 trillion climate change policy of renewable energy. And they want more solar panels. That means you need more silver.
Right.
So I think the silver gives you much more of the upside and the premium of 40% to buy silver coins.
Right. And gold, but we heard you talking about the potential of having our gold taken away from us again. I mean, the 1930s. I do know this, Frank, that in the 19, not that I was here then yet, not quite that old, but in the 1930s, the gold miners did extremely well. So I would suggest to people that they want to own gold and the mining shares as well, right?
You took my thunder away on that one. Because the best one, it's alive, was not alive today, Homestake.
Yes.
So Homestake went up 500%.
Right.
Gold mines in Canada went up 800%. And so all those smart Americans all of a sudden pivoted. They couldn't own their gold. They bought gold stocks. And the dividends were paying out huge dividends. There was next to no dividend tax.
Right.
So there's no doubt the gold stocks had a huge run. And there's better discipline by boards of directors and CEOs today than there was 10 years ago with egregious acquisitions, which diluted the reserves and cash flow and revenue per share. So I just really feel bullish that if you don't have 10% minimum weighting, you're putting your portfolio at great risk, and especially if you have believe in all this political uncertainty. Sure. Another positive note is my JETS ETF.
Uh-huh.
My JETS ETF is becoming a leading indicator. It crashed just before all the COVID lockdowns. It caught the news in January, and it wore. And year to date, it's outperforming the S&P 500.
Interesting.
So all this negative news is still outperforming. Sort of shares with me that, you know, that it's a leading indicator like PMI.
Yeah.
And China's PMI was very bullish this week. So that's strong for commodity demand if they don't go to war.
Yeah, well, that's a big if. Let's
and I don't think they will. I don't bet on that. But I think that they like to beat their chest like a big gorilla.
Right.
And we've got to be able to just be calm and clear of how we navigate it. But Jay, we live in the greatest nation. It really is, because if you had to live in these other countries, and I travel to them all, dirt roads and corruption everywhere. We're also a very critical nation. We have freedom of speech to be able to critique. These other countries cannot critique their politicians. They cannot critique. Prime Minister Trudeau's taken away the rights of assembly, trying to take away your rights on social media. So on a relative basis, this is a great nation.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you, Frank, but I think we have to protect and make sure we keep that right of that First Amendment right, because if we lose it, and there are certainly people here that would like to take it away from us as well, we can't allow that to happen. Frank, one more thing. You mentioned the possibility of cryptocurrencies being backed by gold. Are you worried at all about the central bank digital currencies and what that might mean to our liberties? The Chinese, as I understand, they have social credit scores. You know, if you don't say the right things or do the right things, you can't get on a bus or a train or whatever. Is that something you're concerned about here? Or do you think wiser, smart?
I'm concerned about it everywhere, as long as they keep listening to organizations of the World Economic Forum. That's just my... They're so powerful. And by the way, the marketing they do and the videos they do, they're so informative, you know, but you have to be able to grasp, they manipulate words. So that you slowly see big shareholders' rights are becoming small and stakeholders' rights are becoming big.
Right.
And it has to do with everyone in the supply line. And so that will turn around and hurt the capital markets.
Right.
That will hurt the capital formation. And America is the most creative country in the world for the formation of capital for a great idea.
Right.
You don't have that in Europe. Right. And so the best, smartest European entrepreneurs come to America to be able to show their brilliance, just like the best athletes come. You see the best Croatians playing NBA here. You see the best small little countries, but the best as an athlete, they want to play in the NBA. That's something that makes America so great.
Right. Okay, GOAU is your ETF for gold shares, and that's one I think people should really keep an eye on as well. Frank,
I love it. It's so smart. What it does is doing exactly, Jay, what we forecasted to do based on 10 years of regressional analysis. And now past performance, no guarantee of future results. But I see the try to GDXJ trying to emulate it more. Okay. And but we will kick out stocks rather than having 60, 80, 90 stocks. It's only 28. Three of them are the three big royalty companies, and they rebalance every quarter. The other 25 are based on their performance. Like, are you good enough to make the NBA? Uh-huh. Are you good enough to make my team? Yeah. And every quarter, if they don't make five factors I have, which I back tested, they're out. Right. So I think that that's and it's inexpensive, 60 basis points for, I call it quasi-active management.
Oh. That's very good. Very good. Frank, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us today. You know, it is I should talk to you more often probably, because you do sort of provide an upbeat view, which is lacking from this show a lot of times. We tend to dwell on the things that are threatening what we have. I agree that we are the greatest nation in the world. I just want it to stay that way. And I know you do too. Frank, thank you.
That's because we can do that. You know, we can critique and what the viewers should listen to and realize in other countries you can't.
Right. Well, and again, there are those that would like to shut that off too, but we have to keep fighting for it. Frank, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure having you again.
All right. Happy investing.
Bye. All right. Well, folks, that is it for this week. Next week, Alistair McLeod is my main guest. We'll probably have another person that I don't know who it will be yet. But until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.